Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Predator of the Seas, a history of the slave ship that fought for emancipation, by Stephen Taylor. Narrated by Mike Cooper. Author's note. History is ever susceptible to new ways of telling. In a maritime world, once dominated by battle and biography, rich layers of the seafaring past have been opened up through the lives of ships, from those titans of war, the Temeraire and Bellerophon, to such agents of discovery as the Beagle and Erebus. This narrative takes what many listeners, like the author, may find a more disturbing passage. The transatlantic slave trade has generated a vast compendium of books, treatises, and analyses. Given the significant and at times dominant role of Britain in that atrocity, the country's involvement remains the subject of tortured reflection and recrimination, and of heated debate on such matters as the need for reparations. In a parallel strand of the story, numerous volumes have been dedicated to the abolition movement in Britain, and more recently, the Royal Navy's campaign to suppress the trade. The present book may be found to inhabit an awkward place in these bibliographies. In following the story of a single vessel, it is set in the two distinct and separate theatres that she occupied, Brazil and West Africa. The time frame, too, is narrow, covering less than a decade in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, when European nations were coming to terms with peace, Britain was trumpeting its status as a world power, and across the Atlantic, new states were on the rise in the former Luso-Hispanic colonies, which had broken away from their European rulers. In approaching these two worlds, I anticipated a narrative that would emerge in fairly stark terms. The malignancy of the trade in humans needs no emphasis, and in the new world order that was taking shape in the 1820s, Britain was setting a reformist agenda for European states. Yet there were cautions, too, against casting this as an allegory of good versus evil, the Royal Navy against the slave trade. In the words of the philosopher Walter Benjamin, "There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism." The extent to which British seafarers and merchants had previously participated in trafficking, and that West Indies plantation owners continued to supply British consumers with the fruits of enslaved labour until the 1830s, set that in context. As it turned out, the case could be taken further. In the polemics surrounding imperialism, an argument has been made that in trying to stop other states profiting from slavery, Britain was merely protecting its own economic interests. Within the narrow time frame defined by the life of the brig that set sail as the slaver Henriquetta and was mourned as the acclaimed rescuer Black Joke, is to be found ambiguity and complexity in various forms. The life of a single vessel that occupied both these worlds evolved into a metaphor for the paradoxes of humanity. I have written previously about aspects of Britain's maritime past in the Age of Sail, mainly naval, with diversions into trade and social history. Researching this book opened up a quite different world. The bravado, the derring do, and victories of the war years were not to be seen. What is revealed instead by the campaign to end transatlantic slavery is the mishandling of a great endeavour. The preventative squadron was not lacking in able and dedicated officers and men, but it was neglected by the authorities at home and so deprived of resources as to leave it constantly outrun by a new enemy at sea. The Royal Navy itself, it may be argued, had been left demoralised and vastly reduced since 1815, with many ships laid up, officers sent ashore, and almost the entire force of seamen discarded without pay. In the post-war years, sailors made up the largest contingent of London's beggars. Of the history of slavery, I had little knowledge. Research into that subject, the extent of British involvement, and in particular details of the conditions in which men, women, and children were transported, the latter in harrowing numbers, proved long and grim. Africans' engagement in enslavement came as another discovery. I have written about and spent much of my life reflecting on Africa's colonial past. Southern Africa was the world into which I was born and raised, and which, well after I departed as a young man, bequeathed a longing that drew me back as a news correspondent and to travel across the continent from east to centre and south. West Africa's history opened a further door. In seeking to distill these worlds, I've been bound to pass over a great deal of history. The transatlantic slave trade lasted nearly 400 years, while ships and vessels of the preventative squadron spent more than half a century, 60 years in all, cruising off West Africa before it could be said that battle had been won. The most comprehensive study of the squadron's campaign is Peter Grindal's Opposing the Slavers, a work to which I returned repeatedly for the overall picture and have cited throughout. Grindal was a long-serving Navy officer, and his landmark work was the product of experience, meticulous research and care. It is no disrespect to say that the vastness of his canvas obliged Grindal to pass over some of the individual stories, nuances and details cast up by a more narrow focus. What emerged most strikingly from my research were the voices of those drawn in by the campaign, in Africa as well as at sea, women as well as men. The period, the start of what has been termed the Age of Reform, was one in which views and values were evolving both significantly and rapidly, and the accounts of witnesses, and often their actions, speak for the heartfelt instincts of common humanity. Of those who served, many died, and some were traumatized. The resources for telling this story were highly variable. While naval records for the preventative squadron are comprehensive, most of the documents relating to Bahia's slave trade were destroyed in the 1890s, and research done on my behalf at Salvador's State Archive brought little to light that had not already been set down in previous studies. The Henriquetta's life is thus darker than that of the Black Joke in more respects than one. The most significant gap, however, lies in Africa. The archives in Sierra Leone, relating to the men, women and children rescued from slavers and resettled in Africa, have deteriorated, yet been salvaged and digitized, thanks to the efforts of academics. But no amount of doctoring or research can bring to light details of the millions of Africans carried into enslavement, or their personal stories from origin to destiny. As to the central figure of this narrative, the Black Joke herself, she was, it should be said for the sake of clarity, never a ship. In the Age of Sail, that term was applied to a square-rigged structure of three or more masts. As a brig, she had just two masts, and was otherwise described as a vessel. In seeking a metaphor for this object, launched as an agent of suffering, but seen as a thing of exquisite beauty by seafarers, I was repeatedly drawn to a piece of music by a great composer, the master of German Lieder. Amid the outpouring of masterpieces that defined the final months before his death in 1828 from syphilis, aged 31, Franz Schubert penned perhaps the most haunting of all his songs. Der Doppelgänger is a dead or dying man's vision of a tormented, ghostly double, of his younger self. In another definition, the word Doppelgänger represents an evil twin. As it happened, the Henriquetta had, at that point, just set forth on her mission of rescue as the Black Joke. Prologue. 10 years after Napoleon sailed into exile on St. Helena, the frigate Maidstone stood at anchor off another tiny Atlantic landmass. Prince's Island was an unlikely refuge, scarcely 10 miles by 4, and lying just 1 degree 37 minutes north of the equator within the Gulf of Guinea, but for the flagship of the Navy's latest campaign, it provided a welcome respite. In September of that year, 1825, the temperatures of equatorial Africa were tolerable and the tornadoes had passed, along with the wettest weather. From his quarterdeck in West Bay, Commodore Charles Bullen could look out on dense jungle, a land of green swept by the jagged outline of spent volcanoes. With its rich soil, abundant vegetation and sweet scent, Prince's Island had resources essential to his squadron's well-being, and in this week at rest, Bullen indulged Maidstone's hands. Off duty, men dangled lines from the forecastle for fish. Boats went ashore daily, returning with fruit and water. But seamen were no bathers, so the palm beaches at hand would have had little allure. Besides, they had other matters in mind. This idyll was going to be brief. Soon they would return to the most perilous peacetime operation in the Navy's history. Commodore Bullen was late to this fray, still finding his way in waters that offered no prospect of reviving past glories. Aged 45, he had been at sea since he was 10, rising to command through distinguished service, along with a degree of patronage, and with battle honours from Camperdown and Trafalgar to show for it. Years on half pay followed Napoleon's defeat before he was offered the Maidstone, flagship of the preventative squadron in West Africa, and command in a war like no other. It seems unlikely that Bullen had embarked with any particular notions of service to humanity. Resilience, popularity with his fellows, and experience were what suited him for the grueling task. Patrolling the bights of West Africa was a dreaded duty, carrying the highest mortality rate of any Navy station. It had indeed been the death of his predecessor, an old friend, Sir Robert Menz. Like others who served here, however, Bullen soon found himself affected by new visions of suffering. Although familiar with sea battle, the calamity wrought on bodies by cannonballs and flying shards of timber, he was overwhelmed by discovering the conditions in which captive Africans were being transported across the Atlantic. He wrote, after boarding his first slave vessel, "The filthy and horrid state I found her in beggars all description. Many females were in an advanced state of pregnancy, and several had infants of 4 to 12 months of age. All were crowded together in one mass of living corruption." The torment of captive women and children is a recurrent theme in the observations of those who served in the preventative squadron. Navy vessels had started cruising from Sierra Leone in pursuit of slavers soon after the 1807 Act of Abolition, but it was only in 1819 that the preventative squadron was permanently stationed there. A year since arriving in Sierra Leone, Bullen was getting to grips with other grim aspects of his command. The squadron, established 6 years earlier to enforce the Act of Abolition, declaring the slave trade illegal, may have reassured reformers at home that Britain was doing its righteous duty. But those on Navy vessels, ordered to halt the flow of bodies taken from Africa north of the equator, knew better. Whitehall's diplomatic efforts had failed to deter states determined to continue the trade. The Admiralty, still basking in the naval triumphs of the Napoleonic Wars, was detached. To put it charitably, the lords who composed the Navy's administrative board were oblivious to the scale of the challenge. More explicitly, they appeared disinterested. Bullen's squadron lacked the resources to confound, let alone thwart, the slave traders of Portugal, Brazil, Spain, and France. A week's respite at Prince's Island, known today as Principe, was all the Maidstone could be spared, and having obtained water, food, and fruit from the Portuguese governor, Don José Ferreira, who, it was known, was a keen slaver himself and would be engaging in the trade again as soon as they had departed, she raised anchor on the 13th of September and sailed north for the Gulf of Guinea. As sea conditions go, these were not especially hazardous waters. Ships' logs often refer to storms in the Gulf as tornadoes, but these were violent squalls rather than the cyclonic hurricanes of the Indian Ocean and Caribbean, though they did descend so suddenly as to evade warning by barometers and were accompanied by thunder, torrential rain, and lightning that could topple a mast. The Guinea current, pulsing steadily eastward along the coast at up to 3 knots, was a more predictable factor, albeit one that frustrated and hindered mariners beating westward into southwesterly monsoon winds. The real perils came not from the sea, but the shore. European seafaring states had by now been engaged for more than 3 centuries in trafficking humans from a stretch of coast running some 3,300 miles along the latitudes of West Africa. The white man's grave, they called it. For the naval personnel assigned to suppression operations, yellow fever and malaria were the main causes of mortality, but other conditions, from leprosy to yaws, rendered even their Sierra Leone base what one called a pestiferous charnel house. As for the glory to be won in battle, there was none. In truth, the enemy had the upper hand. The insatiable appetite across the Atlantic for slave labour, principally in Brazil and Cuba, had stimulated a surge in the number of vessels engaged in trafficking. Over the previous 5 years, it is estimated, some 226,500 captives on 200 vessels had eluded the Navy's patrols and been landed in those two states. The problem, as was often pointed out to the Admiralty, was insufficient and unsuitable ships. Bullen's squadron was larger than its predecessors, thanks to political pressure, yet it still amounted to a single frigate, 4 smaller warships or sloops, and 2 gunbrigs, and even some of these were notorious laggards. As one old politician of the day would reflect bitterly, if there was a particularly old, slow-going tub in the Navy, she was sure to be sent to the coast of Africa. No such sluggishness constrained the foe. Modern slavers, built for purpose and to order in America, were, as Bullen wrote, very fine, fast sailing vessels. For those being transported, conditions below remained hellish, but when it came to manoeuvrability and speed, the experimental two-masted brigs being turned out by Baltimore shipyards had no match in British designs that were steeped in tradition. HMS Maidstone was a case in point. A 36-gun frigate made for war, she had storage enough to spend months at sea, was suitable for blockade duty, and had quite enough firepower to produce equivalent French or Spanish ships. She had a reasonable turn of speed, too, capable of 9 knots in the right conditions. But as well as a tendency to plunge, she could slow to 3 knots with the sea on her bow, and in these waters that was no match for the pace and dexterity of a slaver brig. Moreover, with 3 tall masts, she could be sighted a great way off from those low-slung races. There was just one element Bullen had in his favour, one he could rely upon to get the most out of Maidstone and serve the cause they had been assigned, his crew. The officers were young, proud of a naval heritage that had come to define British power, and desperate to make the most of what little opportunity came their way in this post-war era of a much reduced Royal Navy. The seamen, products of the same tradition, had a pride and resourcefulness all of their own, being, as one of their officers wrote, pugnacious kind of animals, fond of a little excitement. And while they were all vulnerable to disease, another human resource had started to make up Maidstone's company. Crew, or crewmen, as they were termed by the Navy, were sturdy West African mariners who served alongside and aloft with Jack Tar and proved more resistant to the fevers that would carry off hundreds of their white shipmates. A week after sailing from Prince's Island, Bullen had resumed patrolling the ill-named coast of Bonny. It was wearisome work for the hands, tacking or altering the frigate's course by bringing her head to the wind and round, and a frequent raising and shortening of sail, all in equatorial temperatures and humidity. Nothing had altered this routine for days, when, early on the 24th of September, a brig was sighted coming up on the wind, with the port of Bonny just 26 miles to the northeast. There could be little doubt she was a slaver. The company mustered by divisions, gunners to the 18-pounders, marines bearing muskets, but no warning shot was necessary, no resistance offered. The brig came to, a boat crossed from the Maidstone, and a boarding party went up the side. A grim-faced lieutenant returned shortly to confirm what Bullen had by now concluded from similar previous encounters. The brig's captain had, in a frosty manner, produced papers showing that she was indeed carrying captive Africans, indeed no fewer than 499 in number, however, she sailed under French colours. Well might Bullen have ground his teeth. The French ensign was being used as a flag of convenience by slavers of various states because France remained exempt from the treaties that defined Britain's campaign. Repeatedly frustrated, Bullen had proposed to the Admiralty that such vessels be seized and subjected to judicial scrutiny, but this had been expressly forbidden. So another slaver with almost 500 humans aboard started across the Atlantic. 2 weeks later, the Maidstone had taken up a position off Lagos. The island town set on a lagoon was emerging as a focal point for the trade, so the presence of 6 sail at anchor demanded investigation. Once again, boats set off under the orders of a lieutenant. Once again, he came back exasperated. The 4 Brazilian and 2 Spanish vessels were clearly on slaving voyages, carrying all the usual trading goods, but none had captives stowed below. However tempting it might be to seize these fiendish agents and thus neutralise them, it was forbidden by treaty. Only loaded slavers could be detained, and even then nothing was resolved until they had been sent on for adjudication by a court known as the Mixed Commission. The following day, the 7th of October, began with humdrum routine. 8 bells were struck at 4 a.m. for all sail, men brought up their hammocks, and by mid-morning they'd fed off biscuit and suet. The Maidstone was in 6 degrees 30 minutes north and 3 degrees 44 minutes east, still some 5 miles south of Lagos, when, at around 10 a.m., a lookout shouted down. A strange sail was in the southwest. Men raced aloft and to their stations. The Maidstone's log relates events over the next 9 hours in stark terms. At 11, employed as most necessary. Tacked. Noon, light breezes and fine. 4, moderate and cloudy. Tacked. 6, chase on weatherbeam. 8, lost sight of chase. The stranger had simply vanished, stealing over the horizon like a phantom. An account gathered weeks later by a British intelligence source provides more detail of the incident. The strange sail had been among the six vessels anchored at Lagos. A two-masted Brazilian brig, she had been in the process of loading a cargo of captives when Maidstone appeared. Hastily, they were disembarked, the source reported, just in time to escape capture. On the departure of the Maidstone, the slaves were again embarked and they proceeded to sea. Soon afterwards, the Maidstone appeared and gave chase. A calm or light winds enabled the brig to escape. She is armed and had prepared her guns for resistance. 22 days later, the Henriqueta, for that was the brig's name, landed 504 captives at Bahia in Brazil. Her owner, José de Sequeira Lima, was there to welcome his favourite vessel, celebrate the fortune she was making for him, and chortle with her master at having reduced the mighty Royal Navy to bumbling fools. Another resident of Bahia, William Pennell, watched and fumed. The British consul was a bitter foe of Bahia's slavers and had been making inquiries of his own about Henriqueta's voyage. Some captives, he reported, had died on board, but with regard to the circumstances and number, there has been concealment. On one point, however, he and Sequeira Lima agreed. The British naval force, Pennell went on, has been ineffectual as regards the illicit trade. Commodore Bullen was no less exasperated. By the end of 1825, having flogged his squadron around the Gulf of Guinea, he had lost 48 officers, warrant officers, and seamen to disease in largely futile pursuits of nimbler quarry. His own ship was feeling the strain as well as being constantly outrun. Her sole trophy was a Spanish schooner, the Segunda Galeja. For all Bullen's exertions, the 292 men, women and children found below and taken to join the rescued population of Sierra Leone were the only souls saved by the Maidstone that entire year. Yet in the chase off Lagos, the Commodore seemingly had a moment of epiphany. Visions of that disappearing vessel, low-sided, raked at both ends, and the sweetest sailor he had yet seen, returned to him in haunting form. On receiving Consul Pennell's report, he discovered her to be the Henriqueta, and she may have been the inspiration for his idea. Later that year, another American-built slaver brig was captured. As was standard practice, she was taken to Freetown, Sierra Leone, condemned and put up for auction. The buyer was Bullen. Bidders at these events were usually local traders, but the Commodore had drawn wisdom from a 14th-century proverb. An old poacher makes the best gamekeeper, as they used to say, or simply, set a thief to catch a thief. The first sailing slaver was renamed Hope and assigned to duty with the squadron. Bullen's innovation was met with thorough disapproval by the Admiralty, but it marked a turning point in the campaign. Part 1. Henriqueta. Chapter 1. From Baltimore to Bahia. January to October, 1824. Quite where her life began is not possible to say. Somewhere among the forests near America's eastern seaboard, perhaps those of Massachusetts or New Hampshire is as close as can be stated. Her true nature, too, is unclear. The native inhabitants here included oak, pine, larch, maple, and elm, of which oak would have been a natural choice, being the most durable. But she was never resilient enough to demonstrate that particular quality, so even her very essence must be left open. Life. Use of that term may be questioned, being applied to a structure of dead timber and a small amount of iron, along with elements of canvas and hemp. Yet old mariners, who had spent more years afloat than ashore and were inclined to invest their sea habitats with character, bad as well as good, were not so constrained. The charms of a ship, wrote one hand, are to a seaman what the charms of a mistress are to a poet. And if one thing can be said about the brig that started her life as the Henriqueta, it is that she was symptomatic of the human condition. She proved capable of instilling dread and hope, misery and devotion. Her story may be likened to a biblical parable. Evidence lacking on Henriqueta's origins extends to the identity of her maker. And because of the manner of her death, a further mystery surrounds just what it was that made her unique. An act of pure destruction would ensure she remained forever an enigma. What can be said is that she emerged from one of the 9 shipyards that lined Baltimore Harbor in 1820 and were redefining America's scope as a maritime force. Britain had established itself as the world's naval superpower through fleets composed of ships of the line, great castles of oak bearing between 70 and 100 guns. But since the War of Independence, the United States had been building a range of small, fast-sailing and manoeuvrable vessels that were also efficient sailing into the wind and highly adept at eluding British blockades. Speed, as one authority put it, was the great deity of American seafaring, and Baltimore shipbuilders like Thomas Kemp and William Price were turning out the fastest sailing vessels to be found anywhere, two-masted schooners and brigs that served privateers and smugglers well, but were especially prized by slave traders. Among those with connections to Baltimore shipbuilders was a powerful businessman living some 1,700 nautical miles to the south in the Brazilian city of Bahia. José de Siqueira Lima had been born in Portugal, but like many colonial entrepreneurs, preferred being in a distant quarter unconstrained by legal niceties. Siqueira Lima had no time for the motherland's submissiveness to its British ally in signing a treaty in 1815 which defined as illegal the loading of African captives from any point north of the equator. Like others who had supported Brazil's bitterly divisive Declaration of Independence in 1822, he sensed fresh opportunity. Bahia, now known as Salvador, had, after all, been founded as the capital of this Portuguese colony in 1549, and remained not only its most important port, but the centre of a sugar trade booming on the back of enslaved Africans. For the economy to grow further, as production in Britain's West Indies colonies must eventually decline following the Act of Abolition, many more would be needed. Siqueira Lima saw humans as a commodity he could supply. Records of his dealings with Baltimore shipbuilders have not survived. The brigantine Siqueira, bearer of his name, was perhaps the first to come from their yards. She was followed by the Carlota, a schooner named after his wife, a reputed beauty. Both vessels had made profitable voyages to the slave coast by 1824 when he acquired another, the perfect vehicle for his trade. Mysteries apart, it is known that the Henriqueta evolved from a design called the Baltimore Clipper. In simple terms, she was a two-masted brig of 256 tons, low-sided and raked at both ends, with dimensions of 90 feet 10 inches on the upper deck and 26 feet 7 inches in the beam. Even on launching, it was unknown how fast she would prove. It was only when she was set under sail that it became clear her shape and form captured seafaring magic. With one vessel in his own name and another in his wife's, it is possible that Siqueira Lima called his new brig after another member of his large and diverse family. Brazilian slavers saw nothing bizarre in investing their vessels with names drawn from Holy Scripture, such as Bom Jesus, Nova Virgem, and São Iago. But Siqueira Lima's taste was for the more personal. Henriqueta offered a dainty, sweetly feminine persona. With a prow and setting of masts that proclaimed her speed, she sailed into Bahia and what would be her home port for the first time in mid-1824. The entry point for Portugal's settlement in the Americas was a panorama of stunning grandeur, a natural harbour extending more than 30 miles from north to south and a similar distance across. An English woman traveller of the day, entering the Bay of All Saints on a sea breeze, described Bahia as one of the finest sights my eyes ever beheld. A city, magnificent in appearance from the sea, is placed along the ridge and on the declivity of a very high and steep hill. The richest vegetation breaks through the white houses at intervals and reaches along to the picturesque church and convent of Saint Antonio de Bar. The very form of the bay, with its promontories and islands, altogether finishes this charming picture. Bahia's paradoxical essence only emerged after Maria Graham and other arrivals came ashore. The natural beauty of the bay, the city's holy splendours, the centuries-old Cathedral Basilica of All Saints, the cobbled square of Pelourinho, were set about on all sides by scenes of human degradation and enslavement. The whole lower town of Bahia is, Mrs. Graham wrote, without exception, the filthiest place I ever was in. Enslaved men bore their burdens to and fro, while vendors and workmen in ragged garments plied their trades on a single narrow street divided by a gutter funneling household waste which fed pigs, dogs and poultry. From here, the privileged were borne by more slaves in cadeiras, a form of sedan chair, to the upper town and another world, beautifully situated on a ridge between the sea and a freshwater lake, Mrs. Graham reported with relief. Here dwelt the city's white gentry. From its founding, almost three centuries earlier, Bahia had quickly evolved into a fulcrum for slave trading across Brazil, its harbour lying on a broadly similar latitude to regions of West Africa directly across the Atlantic. Rio de Janeiro, some 800 miles to the south, became more dominant early in the 19th century as the capital of Portugal's royal family in exile during the war raging in the Iberian Peninsula. Then came peace in Europe, and with it...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?